Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm your host, Courtney Nordstrom, and with me today is Richard Bistrong of Frontline Anti-Bribery, LLC. Welcome to the podcast, Richard.
Hi, Courtney. Thank you for having me on your podcast series.
We know your name, and we know that you're the CEO of Frontline Anti-Bribery Compliance, but can you tell us how you got into the compliance world?
I can, Courtney. I guess one would call it through the dark side, so to speak. I spent most of my career as an international sales vice president for what was a large, publicly traded, and successful manufacturer in the police and military marketplaces, what we would probably think of as the aerospace and defense community. So over the course of a decade, Courtney, I was overseas 250 days a year. I resided and worked out of the United Kingdom for part of that time. And my travel pretty much found me all over the world. So I wasn't focused on any particular region other than everything was outside the United States. So about 10 years after I started that work in 2007, I was the subject of a United Nations Procurement Task Force investigation, which the Procurement Task Force was formed sort of in the wake of what we often think of as the oil for food scandal at the United Nations.
That's interesting.
Right? So we remember that. But when that was over, they formed this procurement task force to look at other potential contract fraud that was occurring at the United Nations. And interestingly enough, the third party or intermediary, the agent for a particular UN contract on food was being investigated. Contract that had nothing to do with me or my former employer. And in the course of that investigation, Courtney, they saw my name appearing on a lot of emails, a lot of correspondence, because I held a defense contract with that same third party for the United Nations.
Oh, okay.
And that's not unusual, because very often in foreign bribery investigations, we can look at the current Unioil scandal, for example. The third party becomes sort of the epicenter or nexus of the investigation. So that's exactly what happened with me. And the United Nations, in addition to conducting an internal investigation, the head of the procurement task force, who's an attorney, his name is Robert Appleton. Well, he was a former DOJ prosecutor in the District of Connecticut, and he ends up sharing the findings of his investigation with both my former employer, who in part dismisses me because of that investigation, but he also is sharing his findings with the fraud section at the Justice Department.
Okay, so he went to the DOJ.
Right, so shortly after getting terminated by my former employer and thinking that's the end of this crucible, I get a call to my attorney that I am the target of the United States Justice Department criminal investigation with respect to violating the FCPA.
I'm guessing that's not a fun call.
That's not the call I ever thought I would get in my life. I have a master's degree in foreign policy from the University of Virginia. I wasn't thinking back then that this would ever be something that I would be dealing with. But Courtney, I also knew that I was in serious trouble. And, you know, I recognized that in my decade in the field, I had corrupt ties, corrupt transactions with a number of third parties in a number of countries. So I wasn't thinking, well, let's let the government take its case to a judge and a jury. I'm thinking this is an awful situation, and whatever opportunities the government might make available for me to potentially cooperate and possibly mitigate the consequences of my decade of conduct, I wanted to hear what that might be. So I ended up becoming an undercover cooperator, what we might think of as an informant, both in the United States and in the United Kingdom, because I'm also now subject to carbon copy prosecution in the UK for conduct that occurred there that was very similar to what happened with my work in the US. So, you know, we often read about carbon copy prosecution and the teeth of international law enforcement cooperation. It's very, very real. So I end up becoming an undercover cooperator for the FBI and the City of London Police for 3 years, and I plead guilty to violating the FCPA in the U.S., and part of my plea agreement is this cooperation, and I get immunity from prosecution in the United Kingdom. All that comes to an end. I end up helping prosecutors in the U.K., in the U.S., and in other countries with some of their cases. Some of them resulted from my cooperation. I end up being a cooperating witness at a trial in the United States. So this all comes to an end in 2012. And part of the judicial process is after the cooperator is through with those cooperation obligations, it's time to get sentenced. So I end up facing 5 years in prison as a result of my plea agreement. The government recommended that I receive no incarceration as a result of my cooperation. And Judge Richard Leon in the District of Columbia recognizes the value of my cooperation, that I, you know, turned my life around, but he feels very strongly, and I happen to agree with him just as strongly, that to promote criminal deterrence, jail time is necessary, particularly in crimes, he said, where people might be facing similar dilemmas to what you faced. So he said, Mr. Bistrong, you know, big crime plus big cooperation doesn't equal probation. Some jail time is warranted because that's how we promote criminal deterrence. And he gave me 18 months. So, Courtney, I served 14 months. You get a certain amount of good time in the federal prison system, and I got a little bit of home confinement. And I come home in December of 2013 after serving my time at the federal prison camp in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. And, Courtney, the first thing I do is I take a very deep dive into the compliance world, because it wasn't something I was thinking about when I was, you know, managing my own case and my own responsibilities and preparing for prison. So it was an exciting time just to read everything that was going on, particularly in this world of anti-bribery compliance. And, you know, it was just wonderful reading these really well-experienced and resourced people and organizations from the legal and the accounting and the audit and talking about this.
You started to research what people were saying about you and about bribery generally?
No, I wasn't really focused on my case, right? I had enough of that. I was looking, you know, that was in the rearview mirror, thankfully. I was looking at what does the compliance field with respect to anti-bribery issues, what does that look like? So I was looking to see what were the viewpoints from the legal practitioners and the forensic, like the advisory firms. So it was just sort of jumping into the water and seeing, you know, what was going on. What were some of the thought leadership saying? What were some of the trends that were being identified?
What is this environment?
All in the sort of anti-bribery environment, correct. Courtney, what I found was, again, this sort of well-resourced, well-experienced field, some really incredible, incredibly smart thought leadership. But what I noticed were two gaps. One gap was, what does this all look like from the business perspective? Like, people like myself or Harold Jack Stanley, the former, you know, CEO of KBR, you know, people who sort of were well-educated, well-compensated, who didn't need to take any risk with their own liberty. Why are people, as Scott Killingsworth said, irrationally calculating risk and getting themselves in all this trouble when they don't have to? What's going on in this field, the business perspective? And part of that is behavioral research. Like, why reasonably good people make unreasonably bad decisions. There's this wonderful field of behavioral research, and you're having one of the leaders give the keynote at the Compliance and Ethics Conference in Chicago, Francesca Gino, who who, you know, wrote a wonderful book called Sidetracked. So I found that not just my own crucible, but that there's this wonderful field of, you know, behavioral research that talks about the dilemmas that people face and how they might respond. So I felt like not wanting someone else to go through what I did. Prison was an awful experience. I got very sick. It had long-term health consequences for me. Like, why not try to help organizations keep people safe? Because if people are safe on the front lines of international business, they're going to keep their company safe. So I started to get a little bit passionate about talking about this field from not a legal, not an audit, not a forensic perspective, but here's what it's like on the front lines of business. So my apologies for that very long answer, but that's how we got on this podcast today.
Yes, and I know that our CEO, Roy, saw you speak here in Minneapolis. And one of the things that struck him enough that he spoke about it on the Unfair and Unbalanced podcast with Tom Fox, was what you said about personal responsibility, particularly when it comes to responsibility when doing your job. From what I recall from the podcast, Tom and Roy were discussing sales generally, and the fact that if you're making bad choices in your sales career, you can't always blame it on trying to make sales. At some point, you have to own up to the fact that you're making bad decisions. Am I characterizing that correctly?
That's right, and I happen to agree with Roy, and I really enjoyed that podcast with him and Tom Fox, where, you know, Roy said, compliance is not waging a war on business objectives. You're expected to be successful, to be effective, but as Roy said, to be effective without cheating. Having a stretch goal isn't necessarily an unspoken message of, we don't care how you get there, you know, and that's playing that victim card if the tide washes out. So I agree with what Roy had to say, and I listened to that podcast a few times. We're going to have a world with goals, and, you know, employees need to be held accountable to making those goals in a way that's lawful and ethical and within compliance boundaries. But I think the flip side of that, Courtney, is that compliance officers need to have sort of an open door, or to show their own vulnerability to say to the field, if right at the start, and we're talking before you get to work, but, you know, having been in a public company, these goals get rolled out well in advance. You know, if you think there's a problem right there, that when you look at the goals and you look at your risk environment and you look at, you know, what some of the practices are that, you know, you think will get you there. If you think there's misalignment, the time to speak up is right then. And that's to say to your compliance or your supervisor, this doesn't exactly make sense where I work. And I think that's the credibility, is when someone from the field feels empowered, like a compliance ambassador, to identify a goal that might not be in alignment with anti-bribery compliance, to speak up then, as opposed to after you miss the goal. Well, Courtney, anybody can say, oh, I missed my goal because I couldn't cheat. Well, that's just, you know, a sad excuse, right? And I don't think that's credible. But to speak up before your boots hit the ground, I think that's a reasonable conversation. And I think an organization that encourages people to digest what those goals are and to say, before you get started, tell us if you have any issues, I think that's a fair interchange.
It really is.
You know,
I agree with you 100%. Not only is it fair, I would think that it would be good to use as a best practice. I've worked in sales. I know that you get your goals and you're basically told, meet them or explain why you didn't, or lose your job. One of the things you're never really given the opportunity to do is on the front end to say, hey, these goals aren't reasonable for X reason. I think allowing that to happen would be a really good piece of a solid anti-bribery and fraud program.
Right, and that's when we hear, you know, an effective compliance officer is a visible compliance officer or a compliance leader. Yeah, and, you know, having a voice of compliance during that process speaks a lot to how an organization is taking it seriously, because as you just shared, especially in a public company environment, these forecasts and these goals, first they roll up the hill because the numbers start with people in the field. They're asked to be given and to provide what they think those goals should be. And then they roll back down the hill after they go through management. So there's plenty of speak up time during that process to say, we want to just make sure that goals are good and that everyone is speaking, you know, to those same goals, not after something's missed and then it's more of the victim.
Absolutely. And this ties in so well with what you're speaking about at the upcoming Compliance and Ethics Institute in September. For all of our listeners, Richard is doing an advanced discussion group. The title of it is, Does Defensible Compliance Mean Understood Compliance? In order for your entire sales team and your entire team generally to feel like they're part of the compliance program, they need to see the compliance officer. They need to hear the compliance officer. And that's not necessarily the same thing as compliance being pushed down from the top. And I said that rather ineloquently, but I bet you can say it a better way.
I know, I disagree. I think that was a great description. And I just read 2 days ago the 2016 Compliance and Ethics Program Objective Survey from July 2016. And I hope, you know, our listeners will download that, because Courtney, it's as good as a companion guide as I could imagine to this advanced discussion group, because it talks about the benefits and objectives of a compliance program. On the one side, we have preventing and detecting misconduct, and I think that's a shared goal of meeting regulatory requirements.
Yes.
Right? So that's the defensible compliance.
Keeping the DOJ happy.
Right, exactly. Keeping the DOJ happy, keeping the SEC happy. And we see a rich debate and discourse on what is the DOJ looking for?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, we can go to our LinkedIn feed and we'll see no shortage of discussion of here's what the DOJ expects if you come in with a self-disclosure, or if there's a proactive investigation, here's what their expectations are.
Yeah, I probably see 12 articles regarding that every day.
I think sometimes I don't want to sound cynical, but sometimes the articles on what the DOJ is looking for is actually longer than the DOJ guidance. So there's no shortage of opinion on this, and it's all well-informed.
I would agree.
So on the other side, we have compliance that's there to promote an ethical culture that promotes sustainable and ethical business, that helps frontline employees do their job successfully, right? It's a partner to success. In the introduction to your survey, it says, when push comes to shove, what's the primary objective? Not to recite the entire survey, but the executive summary is the data revealed a substantial gap in what compliance officers feel the primary objective of a program is and what they think management and the board sees as the objective. So where the compliance teams think executives that were surveyed, they think that the management view of a compliance program is that it's there to meet regulatory requirements. So while the compliance and ethics professional looking at their programs as promoting ethical culture and impacting the commercial workforce, their vision is management looks at it as it needs to be defensible. So as the report concludes, that's not consistent.
No. And in the executive summary, we mentioned that it's disturbingly different. The chasm between what compliance officers are working for every day out on the front lines and what they think that management cares about is so broad and so far. And I think that that's disheartening for a lot of compliance officers.
Yes.
This difference we're seeing between compliance, management, and the board really does tie in with your CEI session between understood compliance and defensible compliance. What inspired you to think of this topic for this year's Compliance and Ethics Institute?
I was doing there was sort of a pre-call, and this was one of the first panels I did in my work. And the panel participants were sort of being polled, hey, you know, what do you want to talk about? So one of my co-panelists said, I want to talk about defensible compliance. And Courtney, without even thinking about it, almost involuntarily, I just said, okay, I'll take understood compliance.
Really?
And I think that was sort of the moment where I realized that there are two different views of this. There's a very robust and appropriate debate about, well identified in your survey, what do the regulators want? But does that mean that should take the focus and the light away from what does the workforce need? And can you do both? And in an environment where, you know, we deal with, you know, budget limitations and resource restrictions, it's not always easy doing more with less. You know, again, going back to the survey, what is the primary objective, or can both of those objectives, understood and defensible, be one and the same?
One of the great things about advanced discussion groups, too, is that you're not going to lecture this audience. It's going to be 50 people in a room having a really rich conversation and a discussion, sharing opinions, best practices, and what they know from their experiences.
That's why I'm looking forward to it, is to hear what the field has to say. Really hoping that there are participants who, some might be in the middle, but, you know, some on the ends of that as well. So I really hope that we have a robust and hearty discussion about what might be the pillars of understood and the pillars of defensible, but what's the least common denominator where those two really, really have to be consistent in a way that's not confusing internally, as to ensure that it really makes sense externally.
In order to be both defensible and understood compliance, do we all need to get on the same page?
That's absolutely right. And it's not always easy managing up compliance, having to, you know, and I think this speaks to, again, the debate of the independence of the function, but feeling empowered to say to the board and to demonstrate to the board, this is just not about what happens if we get that call that we hope we never get from the Department of Justice. This is really about culturing and developing and engaging an ethical workforce that understands our business values, even where we don't have a compliance rule that addresses every single part of a decision-making tree. Okay, this is about an ethical workforce. It's sustainable business. And our view is if it is that, it will be defensible. You know, to hear Andrew Weissman speak about compliance, he's almost saying it needs to be about engaging the workforce. He's almost pushing the compliance field to say, yeah, look at how this engages with your workforce. Look how the organization is incentivized, how the function is independent in terms of decision-making process, what happens if there's disagreement. But he said something, he said, if there's trouble, we're going to go to the source of the conduct, no matter how low on the organization chart, and we're going to look up at the organization and say, where was compliance? that's a challenge for compliance, because again, you're managing, you're trying to impact a workforce that's outside your organizational perimeter, but yet everybody's on the same team.
I'm going to reference yet another episode of Unfair and Unbalanced, where Tom Fox mentioned that the only guaranteed failures in compliance programs come from the people. Regardless of the amount of training that anyone receives, some people are just going to make bad choices.
Right.
And I think that's a really interesting point, even though it may be kind of a defeatist way to look at things.
Right. That's right. And I've heard Roy talk about that and write about it. I mean, look, you're going to have people and they're going to try to game the system for their own benefit. And that's where a tight program with good rules, records, and controls, you're going to try to capture that conduct as quickly as possible as to minimize the cost and consequences to the company from a financial and a reputation perspective. It almost goes without saying that that compliance program needs to be robust enough that that sort of behavior gets triggered early, quickly, and you know, then the company has the options as to how it gets dealt with. We're not talking about abstract concepts. We're talking about, yeah, compliance is part of helping people to do their job ethically, helping to promote, you know, ethical and sustainable business. But it's also about catching people when people need to get caught.
Yeah. And I think that's an important aspect of it as well. There are these rules and a system exists to catch these outliers.
Yeah. And that goes back to the beginning of the discussion. That's when you don't really need to hear, well, I did it because, you know, I had a stretch goal, or, you know, I did it because that's how I had to make my number. That's not the time to play victim. If you really feel that way, before your boots hit the ground, that's your time to speak up and say, I'm looking at my sales chart here. This could be a problem. We talk about it before we actually get into the next fiscal quarter, and I'm expected to implement this. Let's chat about it.
Richard, I think we've come pretty full circle in our discussion today.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you for joining me on the podcast today. I really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy schedule to have this conversation with me.
Same here, Courtney, and I hope that we will get a nice group for the advanced discussion group who feel just as sort of passionately on one side or the other or in the middle about this issue, because I'm really anxious to hear, you know, what the field has to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope you write a blog post about it.
I promise I will. Thank you.
Great. I'll see you soon. And thanks again for taking the time out to record with me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Courtney.